Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2022 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvineawards.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in California's decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, a Valley author tells us about his new historical novel, chronicling the experiences of Japanese Americans during World War II. And we also look into vaccine hesitancy. But first, even as activists in Fresno celebrated the verdict in the Derek Chauvin case this week, they say it's just one win in the perennial struggle for racial justice. Organizers say the key is police reform, and as FM89's Sarith Hawk reports, plans are also underway to march in honor of the victims of police violence.
The wind is picking up outside Fresno City Hall, where community members are gathering just hours after the verdict was read in the Derek Chauvin trial, guilty on all three counts, second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. A painted portrait of George Floyd is placed at the center of the gathering, organized by the Fresno State NAACP chapter.
With the wire's wrapped around it now.
Okay. Pieces of paper attached to the portrait flutter in the wind. They list the names of those killed in the U.S. by police violence.
That killed George Floyd. That killed Dante Wright. That killed Breonna Taylor.
Crisanti Valencia of Youth Organized California uses a bullhorn to lead the crowd in a healing ritual.
Take one deep breath in. And exhale.
She says it's important to process this moment in history.
I think a lot of us are feeling so many emotions. I think there's anger, there's sadness, there's joy, and I think all these emotions coexist together.
Fresno State NAACP Chapter President DeAngelique Jackson says it's vital to gather together on a day like this.
This last year for all of us has been extremely hard, and I can be real and say that I just needed to see my community members' faces, give you all kind of like a socially distanced virtual hug, if you will.
Jackson called on a diverse group of community activists to voice their reaction to the verdict and what it means for Fresno. Gloria Hernandez says it was an emotional release.
Then I cried when I got home and I heard the verdict. I cried a sense of relief, a sense of justice.
Both Hernandez and Jackson are members of the Fresno Commission for Police Reform. A meeting planned the same day was rescheduled following the verdict. The commission was going to discuss a list of recommendations to implement within the police department. Hernandez makes a request to the crowd before her.
But I'm asking you to call your mayor and ask him to abide by the Police Reform Commission recommendations.
The speakers say the George Floyd case opens an important conversation with law enforcement. It was a point made earlier in the day when a group of Fresno's religious leaders stood with city leaders at Courthouse Park in front of the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial. They called for the community's peaceful approach to the verdict.
When these things happen across our nation, it causes great pain in our community.
That's Pastor B.T. Lewis, leader of the African American Clergy Caucus. Before the verdict was read, he spoke about living with the fear that his children could one day be added to the list of names of those killed in police violence.
We want to do everything within our power to ensure that our children get home safely every day. And I know everybody doesn't have that concern, but I certainly do.
Lewis says in Fresno, the key has been building relationships in the community, especially with law enforcement.
For years, we have tried to work with our justice leaders in Fresno to try to prevent as much as possible the kind of things that are happening in other cities from happening in our city. We want to create not only a place of protest. Protest is great, but we also want to make sure that we encourage healing in our city.
healing that is on full display at the gathering in front of Fresno City Hall.
You guys understand that this verdict that we got today was not a national win. That verdict that we got today was not a win for the city of Fresno. That verdict we got today was a win for the Floyd family. And we're celebrating that for them, with them.
DeAngelique Jackson emphasizes the work is really just beginning for racial justice. Part of that work was last year's peaceful Black Lives Matter march after the murder of George Floyd.
Our one-year anniversary for the historic march that we led on May 31st of 2020 is coming up. And we will be doing an anniversary march.
The march attracted more than 3,000 people. Jackson hopes to make the march even bigger this year.
That date will fall on Memorial Day this year. And that meaning to me and the thing that it symbolizes is perfect. We have lost so many soldiers.
It's why the Fresno Commission for Police Reform is pushing for change. On Tuesday next week, they meet with city leaders to talk more about which recommendations are being implemented. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Sarith Hawk.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Last summer's reckoning over police brutality against Black people led both Fresno and Bakersfield to establish commissions of community members charged with making recommendations for reform. I checked in with some of the activists involved to see how the work is going and to hear their response to the murder conviction of Derek Chauvin. I spoke with Bakersfield activist Natisha Johnson and Arlena Waller, along with DeAngelique Jackson, president of the Fresno State chapter of the NAACP, and Fresno-based anti-gun violence advocate Aaron Foster. It has been an emotional week, and I think it would be worthwhile to just check in with you all. I know as a Black person, I've had a lot of mixed feelings this week. And so I'd like to hear how you're doing and get your reaction to the verdict. So DeAngelique, let's start with you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me here today. It definitely means a lot to just have a space to talk about just the happenings of this last week and honestly this last year. I think the verdict, along with just the news of finding out so many young Black people and people of color have lost their lives to police brutality and gun violence over the last few weeks, has been very hard for me. In reference to the verdict, I know I can say from a personal perspective, I thought that I would experience joy or content of some sort, and I really didn't. If anything, I felt more anger and dissatisfaction than anything else, because I feel that with this case, one, it wasn't a national win or a win for our local communities. It was a win for the Floyd family in the sense that we can only pray that they got peace and some form of justice from this case. But when I review and I look at that video and we find out that it was longer than 8 minutes and 46 seconds, and we just find out just how gruesome that moment really was for the bystanders and for Mr. Floyd, it really comes down to the fact that I believe it shouldn't have been second degree unintentional, that it should have been the full weight of the law. And the fact that we as a people have to, in this sense, really settle for less than what is owed to us and to the Floyd family and to Mr. Floyd himself was very hard for me to process. So I can only hope that it's a beginning, and that with the thousands of other cases of Black men who have lost their lives, it's only uphill from here when we talk about justice and just looking at things through the eyes of the court.
Natisha, how are you doing?
There is a sense of anger. You know, there was never a sense of elation, never a sense of victory as won. When I heard the verdict, I was angry because there will never be justice. There will never be justice for his family. When we talk about justice, just means whole, to make something whole again. And we can't bring him back to life. And there's no restoration in that for his family, for the community. And so it is a start. It is a start. It is accountability. It's within accountability to now start, so hopefully that we could be proactive in navigating towards that justice. So there's a lot happening here. Many people wanted to jump and joy, but we didn't give them that, because this is only the beginning. This is the process. So now it's time to work together, bring both partnerships together, the police and the community, so we can have a broader public transparency and visibility so this won't happen again, because it continues to happen. When black men are dying at the same rate as white men, then I can say there's some justice behind that. You know, not that within the deaths, but, you know, we have black men dying four times the rate than white now. So no, there's no justice. There's still a little anger, but I know that there are a lot of people working in the community, in their communities, to make sure that we are working in that transparency, in that visibility, so we can start healing.
Erin, I'd love to hear your thoughts about this week and this year.
So this week and this year, and all the years before now, since I've become aware of the disparity, heavy, super, super heavy. I'm glad that we had some sense of accountability. I'm not frowning on it. You know, the biggest room in the world is the room for improvement. So now that we started this model, I would love for us to just keep moving forward with holding people accountable for senseless acts of violence. That's the culture that I want to see happen in the United States. Because before now, it was like they had a right to kill black men. And the way that he got killed was so heavy. I have a picture of his face with the pee and everything. I was like, if that wasn't brutal murder, what is? I mean, just because they didn't beat him to death, but they held him and made him die slow, was worse than being knocked over the head or shot in the face. And he begged and pleaded for his life. And every time I think about it, it brings a pain to my heart, because I know that he's not the only one that suffered that. He's just the only one that we saw. So from this point on, I think that we should hold people accountable for misconduct without demonizing the entire force, because it's crazy that people hate the police until they need them. So I'm not anti-cop. I'm anti-bad cop, 100% anti-bad cop. And they should be, if they break the law, they should be held at a higher esteem than citizens, because their job was to uphold it. So they should have stiffer consequences.
And Arlena, your reaction. How are you feeling?
So heavy, right? This has been really heavy. And like many of the other panelists, when that verdict came, you would think you would cheer. But I wept. I wept for so many who was in that same situation and never had the law enforcement held accountable. I wept because not only does this man make horrible decision to murder someone that he was charged to protect and serve in a public lynching, that his family is also suffering because of his decisions. I wept because I realized in that moment that the system has failed us so much that we didn't know if this person would be held accountable or if they would be let free. I wept because truly, if you look all over the world, where people publicly said, this is murder. And we went through a trial and we were nervous. We didn't know if the system would fail us yet again. And I realized at that moment that I had been holding pain at a cellular level for more than a year. And so in that moment, all I could do is just lay my head down in our conference room and truly weep. Weep for our nation. Weep for our black boys. Weep for our black girls. Weep because law enforcement has not did a good job at getting the bad cops out of the system. And so we're seeing each other as the enemy because we have a system that has failed us. So even today, I'm heavy because I have taken the time to look through each one of our leaders' social media, and they have not stood in solidarity with us. We had one law enforcement make a statement. We had one elected official make a post. Where's the solidarity? So I wept. and I'm still heavy today.
All of you in different ways are working and have been working to change systems in order to bring more peace to our communities. And certainly this past almost year since the murder of George Floyd has prompted a national conversation about police reform. And so I think my question moving forward is, we've been talking about it for quite a while now. Where do things stand today here in the Valley as it pertains to enacting the kinds of change that you have been asking for and advocating for? So, D'Angelique, I know that you have been a part of the Fresno Commission on Police Reform, which has made several recommendations. How have the conversations been, and how optimistic are you that the recommendations that the commission put forward are going to result in meaningful change?
I wish I had more optimism is, I think, the best way that I could say that. I wish I had more optimism in regards to our own city and the reform that we're implementing. I think that we are definitely in a very interesting place. After the march that my organization, my chapter, Fresno State NAACP, hosted last year on May 31st, I think the city responded fairly quickly with the creation of the Commission for Police Reform. But what came after that, once it finalized in November, was silence. And I think that I can chalk that up to having an administration turnover, with having our new mayor come into office, with having a new police chief come into our city. But there's a lot of miscommunication currently. We're supposed to be moving into the implementation phase of the commission, and I was lucky enough to be selected as a member of that. But the communication that we're getting from the city, specifically from the city manager's office, has been lacking. And just the desire to want to partner with all of the committee members for this implementation process, to learn our schedules, to really meet us where we are, and to, for a lack of better words, just to bridge that gap, I feel that part is lacking in the conversation. I know that the police department has been vocal in saying that there have already been 23 of our recommendations that have been implemented, but we need to be talking about what those are. And while it's phenomenal that, you know, our new police chief has come in with so much fire and a genuine desire to want to change the department for the better, there needs to be communication with the people on that part. And I can only hope that, you know, as we get this figured out over the coming weeks, we're supposed to be meeting next Tuesday, that this will get cleared up with our first official meeting. But I'm definitely lacking optimism, on top of just seeing what's happening throughout our nation right now with police brutality and gun violence. It's been very hard. And for myself as an organizer, it almost makes me wonder, you know, am I doing enough? Am I going to be able to create the change that I know that this city needs? Yeah, I feel I have more to say on it, but I'm kind of just going to stop right there, because I just feel myself kind of getting emotional around that topic. You know, like, it's been a year, and I feel our city could be a lot further than what we are right now.
Natisha, you're involved in similar work with the Bakersfield Police Department. How have things been going with them?
Well, you know, we started in July 2020. It's the Bakersfield Police Department Community Collaborative. Myself, Dr. Michael Burrows, Trickle Matthews, and Dr. Mark Martinez. And we have finalized our 64-page report, and it's a formalized community-based recommendation on police reform, police capacity, and building trust and greater partnership between BPD and the Bakersfield community. We were able to identify several areas based on the President's Task Force on the 21st Century, which is building trust and legitimacy, communications and community outreach, officer training and education, use of force, police, and oversight. So our report has been done for about 2 months, so it's familiar with the situation with Fresno. But we just had a morning call, because we were challenged with that optimist, because we've
it's been out there for about 60 days now. And so we need something on the books. And now we do have for May the 5th, we will be presenting at 5:15 to the city council. And hopefully that we're able to put an action plan in place to work together to, you know, we are in an urgency right now to move forward. And so this report will help identify those things. We have over 20 recommendations in those areas that we can either implement, some things we can't change, some things we can change, but we have to have that dialogue. We have to have that conversation now that the data is presented. Here is the data. And so May the 5th. And so I'm going to be optimist about it, because working with our police chief, Terry, he has been very open, very vulnerable, willing to change. We have willing to receive the improvements, as well as city manager Christian Clegg. So it's important to make sure that you have people around you that are willing. Now, you know, what the city does, it's up to the city and it's up to the community to fight for that and hold them accountable, to review and to implement and put change in place. We're still fighting over here. It, like I said, this is a start. This is a start to the process, and we want to hold everyone accountable. We want to build better relationships and build our community to work better with BPD. That's our ultimate goal.
Arliana, you were on the show back in June following a conversation that you organized between community members and the Kern County Sheriff's Department. Looking back over the past several months, how was that dialogue going?
You know, it was interesting. You know, back then, obviously with the George Floyd, it ignited a personal fire in me. And I ignited a conversation with the BPD Chief Terry and also with Sheriff Donnie Youngblood, because I needed answers for my boys. So it was a very personal fight. And now serving as the chair of the Kern County Sheriff's Council, Advisory Council, it is a lot of work because you have years of systematic failure that has been normalized through an organization where maybe they weren't even aware, or maybe they were. So now that we're working directly with the DOJ monitoring team, we're able to move rapidly. Whereas before, if we didn't have that muscle, it might not have happened. So we're working internally inside of their systems, inside of their organization, dealing with what we can. You have to work on changing the culture. We could change laws and policies, but if the culture is the same, being able to come in and, you know, really deal with these law enforcement in their mentality and the way they see things, and really being able to show them various biases and putting together curriculum. Because we can't educate them out of a culture, but we're also working to diversify their hiring practice, who they hire and how they hire. More Blacks, more women. Because if your decision-making is all white, you're going to get the same thing. So we're internalizing through that. A lot of positions are coming open, and we're working very specifically with all partners to make sure that it is diversified. The Sheriff's Department is very open. They have admitted we've done wrong, and maybe we don't know how to do it. But they also have said we did the best that we know how to do. One of the things that has been instrumental is honesty. Sometimes it gets heated in those rooms because we're bringing a community honesty, and they're bringing their honesty. But I believe at the end of the day, we both want the same thing, a safe community. We're working through their policies and have made some recommendations that are being implemented. We're working through some of their records. How do they keep their tech? How do they do their cameras? So we've broken out committees. We have about 30 people that are on our council, and we've broken them out in committees so that we can attack this app more than one bite at a time. We can be a china in a bull closet to try and get this thing right. There is some movement, but definitely not enough. But we're working with the community as aggressively as we can. They've already implemented some of the recommendations that we've made, and we're digging and digging and digging, not only to help the community, but also to help them. This has to be a two-way street. But I was a little disappointed that there was not a statement that came from them on yesterday. That was a huge opportunity to show your solidarity And so I am planning to have conversations with the leadership around that. I've already sent out an email to set up a call, because if we're not going to do this together, then why are we even doing it? Our intent is definitely not to be a PR check mark for any organization. So that's kind of where we are. It's a fight. And we've got about 30 council members that are committed to this fight. And they're biting real hard.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Erin Foster, you have been working for years to improve the safety in Fresno through Advanced Peace, which is a program that provides mentoring and training and internships for people who are involved in gun violence or likely to become involved in gun violence. There was years and years of pushback against this idea, but the city reversed course last summer and provided funding for it. I'm wondering what your thoughts are about why the change of heart and how much of it may be connected to this moment of reckoning that the country was facing.
I think that for Fresno, it was a city push. It was pressure from the people on the ground on both ends of town. You know, we have this big divide between the North Fresno and South Fresno, but North Fresno wanted, saw the need for it. We tore into the heartstrings of our city council, and city council passed it. The mayor vetoed it. And then when it came back around, we had a unanimous vote that the mayor couldn't veto. So I give Fresno City Council and the people of Fresno full credit for it. The shift in the country may have helped, but I think the community had the biggest influence.
Well, we just have a minute before we need to wrap up, but Erin, I'd like to give you the last word. What do you want to see moving forward? What are your hopes for the future?
I would like to see true social equity. When I looked up what social equity meant, it was things done fairly and justly. I believe that Black people are 6% of the population of Fresno, and 1% of that 6% commit 40% of the gun crimes. So I would like intensive resources put into that section of portion of our community so that we can eradicate gun violence forever, just get rid of the whole thing. And that starts, we on the ground encouraging gang members not to enlist new members, and to start reimagining what a community looks like. We're trying to get our old community back where elders are the forefront and they're our council.
Well, Erin Foster, Natisha Johnson, DeAngelique Jackson, and Arlena Waller, thank you so much for your work to support your communities. And thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having
us. You're welcome.
Thank you for having us.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Last week, health officials with Fresno County revealed that so many appointments for the COVID-19 vaccine were going unfilled, they ended up redistributing tens of thousands of doses to other counties. But Fresno's not the only county running up against a lull in vaccine interest. Is it due to hesitancy, barriers to access, or something else? To learn more, FM89's Carrie Klein spoke with residents of three Valley counties as part of this week's COVID update. Welcome back, Carrie.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks.
So as usual, let's begin with a Valley-wide status report.
Okay. Generally speaking, we're still doing great in this area. So fewer and fewer people are contracting the virus and fewer COVID patients are showing up in hospitals. We're right around 200 new cases each day, which is the lowest average we've seen since early summer. Deaths have not improved quite as much and are still hovering at around 50 per week. There's been more advancement this week in the state's reopening blueprint. Now, most counties are in the orange reopening tier, including Mariposa, Fresno, Kings, Tulare, and Kern, and Madera and Merced remain in the red tier. More than 630,000 people in our region have now been fully vaccinated. That's a little over a fifth of our population. And then another 11% have been partially vaccinated.
So everything seems to be trending in the right direction. And yet last week, as we said, tens of thousands of vaccine doses in Fresno went unused. How did that happen?
Well, in the last 2 weeks, there's been a steep drop-off in the number of vaccines being administered. But that's not just in Fresno, it's across the state. The numbers fluctuate day by day, but as an example, in our region, for 5 weeks in March and early April, there was always one day a week that hit close to 30,000 doses administered. Well, this week, the maximum was 14,000. In addition to Fresno County returning doses last week, so did Tulare. They redistributed 15,000 doses, though those just went back into Tulare County through a different entity, Adventist Health, which is opening a clinic at the International Agri Center. So with those two counties as examples, the problem is not supply or the infrastructure to get those shots in arms, but that fewer people are signing up than health authorities anticipated.
Okay, why would that be if the vaccine has still only reached a third of the valley?
Well, there are, you know, a number of possibilities. One is barriers to vaccine access. So all along, we've known that there are communities that are rural, that aren't proficient in English, that don't have reliable internet access or transportation. And it's possible that as time goes on, those communities are making up a higher and higher share of those remaining, and it just takes longer to reach them with the vaccine. But there's also this idea of vaccine hesitancy or skepticism, people who are unsure about the vaccine or flat out refuse to get it.
What do the data show about who is hesitant at this point?
Well, there are lots of surveys out there, and they all break us up into different buckets. You know, for instance, we've heard a lot about vaccine hesitancy among non-white groups, but according to data from the Kaiser Family Foundation, it really appears that the ethnic group that's most likely to say definitely not to a vaccine is whites. Also, adults aged 30 to 49, rural rather than urban residents, and Republicans, who are as much as 5 to 10 times more likely to refuse the vaccine than Democrats. As for why, one big reason is distrust in vaccine developers and the government and the medical field, or concerns about side effects or unintended consequences of the vaccine. And then the news last week about serious blood clots being potentially linked to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine has really scared a lot of people. But, you know, keep in mind, those clots are exceedingly rare, only about 1 in 1 million people who receive the vaccine. That's a lower probability of getting a blood clot from the birth control pill or from getting pregnant, and it's also orders of magnitude less likely than getting in an accident every time you get in your car.
So those are some of the more common reasons for skepticism of the vaccine. What else are you hearing from locals?
Well, so I spoke to a number of people, and I started in Kern County with Donna Clopton. She's one of the founders of the Oildale Community Action Team. It's a grassroots organization that's been trying to make Oildale more prosperous for years. She herself has already gotten her vaccine, but she says she's encountered lots of people who either don't want it or are waiting to see what happens. And a common theme among them is misinformation and even conspiracy theories.
Things I'm hearing is, you know, it's just a flu. You guys are crazy. Some people are saying it's just a cold. Why would you do that? Other people are worried about, you know, my production. You know, if I decide to have more children, is it going to affect my children one day? And, you know, just all kinds of things.
Clopton doesn't feel like she's seen any differences among racial and ethnic groups in her area, though she does say she's seen differences in opinion falling along political lines. Whenever Clopton encounters people who are skeptical, she just encourages them to educate themselves.
All we can do is just keep trying to promote it, tell people to get on to the health department website, and, you know, call them, ask them questions if you need to. You know, call your doctor, ask your doctor questions. Don't go to social media and read what everybody's posting, because that's not accurate.
But even some well-informed people are refusing the vaccine as well.
Yeah, that is absolutely right. And one example of that is Eric Bream, a citrus farmer in Tulare County. He's also one of the administrators of the social media group My Job Depends on Ag. He has not gotten the vaccine yet, and he doesn't plan to, though he won't say never. And for him, the biggest factor is how quickly the vaccine was developed. He doesn't feel confident we know the long-term effects. He's also relatively young and healthy. And so in his mind, that makes for a relatively simple risk-benefit analysis.
I understand what risk I'm putting myself at by not doing it. What I really can't quantify is what risk I'm putting myself at by doing it. I'm not being anti-science or anything else. I'm not being anti-medicine. There's a lot of smart people that put this thing together that understand it a whole lot more than I do. But I believe that everyone should be able to make that choice for themselves under the supervision of their doctor.
He did encourage his mother to get it, however, because her age puts her in a higher risk group. Bream is white. He's pretty open about the fact that he voted for Trump. And it's probably no secret that a lot of other growers and farmers share his views.
You know, growing up in a community that, you know, where agriculture is the basis for the economy and knowing lots of families that are doing this, there's a lot of, I don't know if you call it anger, but, you know, distrust really of some of what the government does. Sometimes it's well-founded and other times maybe not so much, but it exists.
He also says that he's heard a lot of hesitancy among farm workers, some even there working for him, because those who are undocumented are worried either they'll be turned away from the vaccine or that their information could be shared with the government.
So what can be done to boost vaccination rates?
Well, in Fresno County, at least, health officials are analyzing zip code data to find pockets of unvaccinated people, then targeting ads and PSAs to them. They're putting out messages on TikTok and other platforms for younger, social media savvy people. But like I said earlier, hesitancy isn't the only factor here. There are also lots of organizations trying to bring the vaccine to some of those communities that want it but face barriers to getting it. Take Linda Vang. She's a community health worker at Fresno Interdenominational Refugee Ministries, or FIRM, and she primarily works with the Hmong community. Her organization, in tandem with UCSF Fresno and the county, has been putting on clinics 2 days a week that target some of these more vulnerable, harder-to-reach communities. Some of the clinics are held at the FIRM office, but some are mobile clinics going out to rural areas and places of worship.
And how we share these information is through radio station and Hmong TV so that they can hear these news so that they'll be spreading to their other family members saying that, oh, you know, this place is providing vaccines, so let's go get it.
She says FIRM has not seen a drop off in appointments these last few weeks, unlike some of the centralized stationary vaccine sites that are more likely to serve urban English speaking populations.
They say that it's easier to get the vaccine at our place too, because due to having languages that, you know, because they can't speak English well. So having someone there to translate for them and letting them know what they are getting and what kind of information about the vaccine helps them and, you know, boost up their confidence to get the vaccine.
That's not to say vaccine hesitancy doesn't exist in the Hmong and other immigrant and refugee communities. But also, she says, many folks prefer the single dose of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and are waiting until it's back on the market before they sign up for an appointment.
Well, Carrie, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Kathleen.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. The new historical novel, Tears of Honor, by Fresno author James Ardaes, documents the experiences of Japanese Americans during World War II. The sweeping narrative includes two boys from Kalwa who are forced into an internment camp and ultimately show their loyalty to America by joining the army and fighting in the war. I spoke with Ardaes about the novel and the extensive research he conducted while writing it. In the past, you have written mystery novels, you've written true crime. What drew you to historic fiction, and specifically the Japanese-American experience during World War II?
You know, that's a fascinating question. I get asked that a lot, and I've always been an avid reader of history. A number of years ago, I was asked to give a speech about the failures of the American judiciary. And I picked the Korematsu case, which involved the Supreme Court decision allowing the detention of Japanese Americans. And so I did a lot of research in it. And the more research I did, the more fascinated I became with why the government did what it did and with the reaction of the people that were detained and relocated. And then also the young men that went off and fought in Europe while their parents were in relocation centers. So I thought, as I read everything, I decided, you know, nobody's ever written a book from the perspective of all three of these participants so that a reader could understand why the government did what it did and make their own valuation and how it affected the people that were relocated and the motivation of the young men that fought in Europe, which I found intriguing.
So I have a friend who just happens to be reading the book, and she mentioned it in conversation. And so, of course, I said, oh, I'm going to talk to the author. And when I asked her what she thought of the book, she just said to me, kind of shaking her head, I had no idea our country did this. I had no idea. And I would imagine that that's something you're hearing a lot of from people who have read the book.
You know, I am. And I have to say that while I thought that people didn't know a lot about it, I am amazed that how many people knew nothing about it. And I think that's, I mean, it's not a good thing that people don't know anything about it, but I think it is a good thing that people are seeing it and how revealing it is, and for them, how troubling it is. I mean, it really brings home the kinds of things that can happen very easily in our country. And so, yeah, I get that comment. I get that comment a lot, and then people start asking me all kinds of questions. And of course, I'm always happy to answer if I have the time.
Well, one of the things that I had never considered until I encountered your novel is the legal argument that led to the detainment of Japanese Americans during World War II. And you, as from what you said earlier, it seems that that was sort of your entry point to this topic. Can you briefly share or talk about the politics that led to this horrific policy?
You know, there was a general, John DeWitt, on the West Coast, and then an American whose names most people will know, which was Earl Warren, at the time Attorney General of California, with overarching ambitions to become the governor of California. And then the President of the United States at the time, Franklin Roosevelt. The hysteria that existed in the country, the demonization that Earl Warren engaged in with respect to Japanese Americans, and what you really see is a weak government response and a failure to abide by constitutional principles on behalf of our leaders. Because it's really important that our leaders stand up for the Constitution, which is the principal document that binds this country, regardless of color, creed, gender, or orientation. And the failure of the judiciary, when they knew the level of anger in this country after Pearl Harbor, this was a distinct group. They looked different than Caucasians, who were the predominant group in the country. And the willingness to engage in overlooking what the dissenting judges, Justices Murphy and Rutledge and Jackson, engaged in. And I found it very interesting as a retired judge that it was the conservatives who were the ones that were so opposed to this detention, and the liberals, Douglas and Black and Frankfurter and the rest of them, that were so much in favor. I thought that was a very interesting dichotomy. And what it shows is how fragile our freedom and our rights are depending upon who's in charge and the popularity or unpopularity of the reaction to major public issues. And that's what you see here. You saw a group of people who basically were kind of swept aside by the judiciary. I've always regarded it as a major embarrassment and failure on the part of the judiciary.
So I understand that you did 5 years of research into this topic, and it certainly shows in the novel itself. I would love for you to talk a little bit about what you learned in your research about the experiences of Japanese Americans living in the internment camps, because it seems as if your descriptions in the novel go a long way to force us to recognize how much propaganda and the media at the time led to a false remembering of the actual lived experiences of the people who were forced into these camps.
You know, that's really a very accurate statement, a false remembering. You had a group of people that was identifiable, and at that time, probably culturally less assimilated than Japanese Americans would be now. So they had more of a cultural identity than probably young Japanese Americans have now. And part of that cultural identity, I learned, was respect for authority and acceptance. I don't think you would find the same thing now, but I was amazed by the fact that so many people simply locked the doors to their homes and their businesses and drove down or marched down to these detention centers and just turned themselves in. There was a small group of people who resisted, but generally speaking, the group was resentful but passive. And I was curious, and what I really wanted to know is, okay, if I was a young man and somebody locked me up and my parents up and I was an American citizen, I had done nothing wrong other than being ethnically or racially different, and then I was confronted with whether to fight for that country that had locked me up, would I do it? And if I did, why would I do it? And that became to me kind of the overarching question. And then the other question was, or the thing that I learned was how a group of people basically created a society within the confines of these detention centers, a very organized and successful society. And then when it was over, they came back and reassimilated. I thought it was fascinating. I mean, I have a lot of other reactions, but I thought it was a fascinating thing. And then I got to interview so many of these young men that fought. And it was amazing. I don't think I've ever had the opportunity to talk to so many heroic people whose story really hasn't been told to younger generations. I didn't talk about it. I mean, I had to get people to talk.
Was there reluctance to open up to you about this, or was there just a desire to not revisit this painful past?
I think for a lot of the detainees, it was a desire to put the past behind them. And the other thing is the men that fought, they answered my question fairly easily and clearly about why they did what they did. But when you consider what they did, they didn't talk about it much unless you asked them specific questions. As a group, you know, there was no bragging, elaboration, exaggeration. They were very factual about it. They saw some of the most brutal battles of World War II. And when I say brutal, I mean god-awful brutal battles. And they would talk about it, but not in the sense of embellishing themselves or extolling themselves. They would mostly talk about what their friends did and how they did it. And I just found it, frankly, amazing and unbelievably impressive.
Well, I've been talking to James R. Dice, author of the new historical novel, Tears of Honor. It is a sweeping, important, and timely story, and I thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us about it.
You're most welcome. Thank you very much for talking to me.
And finally, we continue our series looking at how people are processing the pandemic. Last week, we heard from a hip-hop dance instructor who says she's taking more time to slow down and enjoy simple pleasures. This week, a funeral manager talks about his experience. He says it's been surreal. FM89's news director, Alice Daniel, produced this audio postcard.
I've never been in a war zone, ever. I hope I never have to be. But I can imagine that the amount of death that can be seen in a war zone has to be something akin to what we've seen here the last 12 months. How do we care for this many people? How do we care for their families? How do we plan funerals for them? How do we get materials that we need? There was a shortage of caskets for a while, urns, you name it, and there was a shortage of it. My name is Anthony Cisneros. I am the manager and partner at Farewell Funeral Service. I don't think there's any funeral home in the Central Valley or crematory that was as equipped as they thought they were to handle that, just the sheer amount and the psychological effect that it has on you and your staff to care for that many deceased persons and their families. Our staff were physically and mentally wore out. Two of my key staff members ended up contracting COVID days apart, injuries, just, you know, repetitive motion injuries from transporting patients or deceased patients from hospitals to funeral homes to the county coroner's office, working, you know, starting at 5 in the morning and working till 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night. working 20-hour days in some instances just to try to keep up with what was going on. We would see families come through here that came through more than once because they had lost loved ones from COVID, more than one family member. I have, in fact, a friend of mine who was in here in early December for her mother. Her family was in here again 4 weeks later for her because she contracted COVID. She was a doctor and she contracted COVID in one of her clinics and she didn't make it. The funeral industry has always been accused of being behind the times, slow to bring in new technology. And one thing that just about every funeral home was forced into this last year was doing things electronically. You know, there are many other industries that do electronic signatures and DocuSign and eDocs for everything. Our industry has never done that. It's always been a face-to-face type of relationship. But with COVID, we had to change that. Most funeral homes had to find a way to provide services online so they could stream what funeral services they were allowed to have, and in order to allow a wider audience to participate that would not have otherwise been able to be here. In the next few months and even the next year, especially as our industry is concerned, we'll start to look back and reflect about how it affected us and just try to process it. Again, for my age group, we've never been through something like this before, so you don't necessarily know how to process it. But I guess you have to, because that's one thing that we learn about grief. Grief does have to be addressed at some point in time. It just doesn't go away. You have to actually stop, acknowledge it, and then work with it, and then work through it. And I think for us, we have to take a page from our own book and take a step back, look at what we've been through, and process it, learn from it. In situations like that, you're going back and you're reflecting as it comes, kind of comes in waves. It recedes and you go about your day and you do your thing, and all of a sudden here comes another wave, you know, and it hits you in the face. You take it, you deal with it, you think about it, and then it recedes and you wait for the next one.
Music for this series was composed by Benjamin Boone. And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2022 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvineawards.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in California's decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.